We are in the period of the Omer. In terms of Chazal, which is really the period of the Tanaim that we are speaking about, first, second centuries of the Common Era, period of the Mishnah, what do we know about this period and the Omer? So what do we know about this? What do we associate between the two? Exactly. Thank you. The somber aspects. Eitan? Yeah. I really can let you give up. The somber aspects, the aspects of Avelut, of the Omer, the mourning of the Omer, have their roots in a number of places, but the earliest ones are in the story of the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. It appears in relatively brief form in the following Gemara in Masechet Yevamot. Amru, it was taught, 12,000 zugim talmidim hayu lo l'Rabbi Akiva. 24,000 students did Rabbi Akiva have. Megivat ad Antipas, throughout all of Israel. V'kulan meitu b'perek echad. And they all died in a single period. Mipnei shelo nahagu kavod ze lezeh. Because they did not honor one another. They did not treat each other respectfully. The Gemara continues, I didn't put it on, that they only stopped dying on Lag BaOmer, thus the celebration of Lag BaOmer, thus the minhag of only observing the Avelut, the mourning of the Omer during the first period up until the 33rd day. Okay. If this is true, and even if it's an exaggeration, something terrible happened here. 24,000 students of a single man, of a great teacher, all died. And the Gemara is pretty explicit, right? People tried to say, oh, it was the Bar Kokhba revolts, and they were fighting in it, and Rabbi Akiva supported Bar Kokhba. I really don't like those sorts of theories. The Gemara says it's because they didn't accord honor to one another, right? That's what it means. Let's not try and read it into something else. What on earth is happening here? What I want to try and do is to build a picture of the Torah world of that time, the sorts of world that these students would have inhabited, and to try and get a sense of what the atmosphere might have been that could have led to such a catastrophe. Just a note, given that we have we've done many classes now on this period. What do we remember about Rabbi Akiva beforehand? What have we learnt in depth of Rabbi Akiva? That's well known, but a class that we've done. No, almost.
That we did on Shabbat.
Good. What's his name?
And he said you made a terrible mistake.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, I was about to report you to Revel.
Made a terrible mistake.
Very good.
Basically, not conceded, but like kind of strategically was like, okay, I'll save the community and not like fight back in.
Good. Rabbi Akiva we saw at the heart of one of the burning machlokot of which direction Judaism should take in the aftermath of the destruction of the temple. That was sort of like the political Rabbi Akiva. Today we're going to be looking at the Rabbi Akiva of Limud, the Rabbi Akiva of Torah, the sort of style of Torah that he creates. And we're going to compare him to one of his teachers and see their sort of their differences. And because what we're going to see is there are two very, very different styles of teaching that are present in the world then. I should say I've taught this as a five-part series in the past. We're just going to do an introduction to the topic as a whole and sort of get into some of the fun of it, and we'll finish it up another time. Source number two, I really mangled it actually. I shouldn't even use it. Let's actually get Pirkei Avot properly. I don't know, where's the Siddur? Anyone see a Siddur? Someone got Safari up on their phone?
Not Pirkei Avot. I mean, I have the app, but not presently.
Okay, right. Pirkei Avot, chapter 2. Should be the Mishnah number 8.
Here's the Safari app.
We read all those initial accounts are somewhat different sometimes in different ones. We hear about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we've already spoken about. Right? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who established all of these Talmidim, these students in the aftermath of the Korban in Yavne, and he had five primary students. Has anyone got the Mishnah? Anyone found it?
I
might
consider when you need one.
Yeah, I don't have it.
Okay, read for us, Gabriel. He has five students, Hayam and he would speak their praises.
Wait,
no, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Yeah, good. Okay, carry on after that. And then. Okay, and after that?
After that.
Yeah, he has students.
Yeah. Until where?
Okay, very good. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus. That's who we want to. That's who we want to hear about. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus. He's going to be a critical character for us. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai would describe, would give praise of his students, and he'd give sort of like descriptions for them. What was his description of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus? He would recount their praise.
Oh, Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus, Hor so sheino me'aba be'tika.
He is a cemented cistern which doesn't lose a drop. This is how Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai describes his student. Now, Gabriella, reading the continuation of the mission, is Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus just one of the students?
No, it's Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanina.
And he's got a number of them, but is Rabbi Eliezer just one of the gang, or is he... Is he...
Well, he's a leader.
Read? Carry on reading.
That is where I was carrying on reading. It says Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanina Shreyed El To Rabbi Yosia Kohen Chassid.
Yeah, I'll finish all the praises, and then what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai say?
Hu haya omer im yiyu kol chachmei Yisrael bekaf moazanayim ve'eliezer ben Horkonus bekaf shnia.
If all of the sages of Israel were on one side of the scales, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonus on the other...
Machria et kulam.
He would outweigh them all. Thus is his greatness. Okay, let's be a bit poetic, everybody. Imagine we're in an English literature class. What does it mean when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai describes his student as bor sid she'enu ma'abed tipa, a cemented cistern which doesn't lose a drop? I could give lots of you compliments, so I would want to give all of you compliments. I'm not sure I would call any of you cemented cisterns which don't lose drops. Except for you, Max. You're a cemented cistern. What does that mean? What's he trying to say?
I assume it means that he retains what he learns, like, long-term, every detail.
Okay. Good. That's a big part of it, retention. He, whatever he learns, he remembers. Excellent. What else do we hear in that metaphor? We could have a lot of metaphors today.
It makes him stronger. Like water makes cement strong.
Interesting. Right. Okay. Good. Hey, Tom? Yeah, and? Gabriella?
Yeah, I think when it says, like, doesn't lose a drop, sometimes you compromise things just to be agreeable, but you're, like, diminishing maybe some of your opinion, and it feels like he's not afraid to be controversial. Like, if he has to go above and beyond to do something that's not so easy, he's not going to lose a drop.
Wow. I've taught this shim many, many, many times. No one has ever given that interpretation of it, but it's an excellent interpretation, the one which we'll see will fit very well. He doesn't lose a drop, he's not going to sacrifice anything. Very interesting. I'll just add something else. What does the water do in the cistern?
Nothing. Just stored there.
Exactly. It sits there. Mayim nimshala l'Torah, right? Water is compared to Torah. In many ways, I'm going to a moth event next week where the theme is water. And I'm like, wow, I should speak about that. That'd be fun. In many ways, water is such a great metaphor for Torah because it's such a flexible metaphor. Continuing in the Mishnah, you still got it up, Gabriella?
Yeah.
He's got another student, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, called Elazar ben Azariah. What's Elazar ben Azariah compared to?
He's a Me'ayin Hamit Gaber.
Ma'ayan. Spring, ever-flowing, right? An overflowing spring. Also a water metaphor, but completely different, right? Mm-hmm. With Rabbi Eliezer, the water sits there. With Rabbi Elazar, similar names, but different, it's Ma'ayan Mitgaber, it's overflowing. So what's the nimsha? What's the explanation of that difference in metaphor? You want to explain it, Michael?
I imagine the latter means that... a spring is always expelling water and sharing.
Mm-hmm. I think it might also be something of... Yeah, Raquel?
Well, I was going to say that it's always, like, moving and changing versus, like, the water that just sits.
Right, perhaps creative, right, is an element of it. It's something new happens with it. It's got energy. With Rebbe Eliezer, he's got, like Sarah said, he's got amazing retention, but nothing particularly happens with it. Let's look at this, the following source, which I love. This is Gemara in Masechet Sukkah, Daf Kaf Chet. Tanu Rabbanan Maseh b'Rebbe Eliezer sheshavat b'Galil ha'Elyon. Once upon a time, Rebbe Eliezer was at a Sukkot program in the Upper Galilee. Lots of lovely kibbutz hotels there. The Sha'aluhu Shloshim Halachot b'Hilchot Sukkah. The people who are there find out, whoa, we've got a Gadol Hador here, and we've all got plenty of questions about Sukkah. It's pretty complicated. How do you put your skach up? What if it blows down? Are it b'minim? And one's broken? Who knows what sort of questions they are? There are 30 questions for him. Wouldn't you ask him if you heard you had this great sage who his teacher said outweighs all the other sages of Israel? If they ask him these 30 questions, and he says to them, 12 amar lahem shamati, 18 amar lahem lo shamati. I've heard the answer to 12 of them. I haven't heard the answer to 18 of them. And they say, kol devarecha eina nela mipi ashmua. Everything you know is just like things that you've heard. You're the God of Hador. You know more than anyone else, right? You should be, how do you work things out? Okay, you've heard 12, maybe you can apply some things across, maybe you can think about it yourself, you know, maybe you could, like, guess, work out some of the answers, educate your guess to the other 18, even if you haven't heard them. Wrong thing to say to Rabbi Eliezer. Oh, no. Rabbi Eliezer didn't like that. Whenever you ask somebody a short question and they reply with a very long answer, you can see you've, look what he says to them. Amar lahem. I have never said anything that I didn't get from my teachers. Miyamai, lo kadmani adam bebet midrash. Nobody ever got to the bet midrash before me. I was always the first one there in the morning. Velo yashanti bebet midrash, and I never slept in the bet midrash. Lo sheinat keva velo sheinat arai. Not a short sleep, not a long sleep. I love that line, by the way. I've taught this class to, like, yeshivati audiences, and I've taught it in, like, very non-learned audiences. And in the non-learned audiences, they never understand that line. They're like, well, okay, like, what's the big deal? You never slept in a Bet Midrash. Why would you sleep in a Bet Midrash? I've also never gone to sleep in a shop or, like, gone to sleep in a swimming pool. Why would you go to sleep in a Bet Midrash? But anyone who's ever spent serious time in a Bet Midrash, in a real Bet Midrash, knows that at any one time, a significant percentage of the Bet Midrash is fast asleep. Right? And some of it...
Everyone else is shouting.
Right, I mean, wow, I used to get to, like, the Bet Midrash at Gush, I don't know, 9:15, 9:30 in the morning. There was a guy who sat next to me. I'd get there every morning, be fast asleep, and he'd stay asleep all morning, and then, like, everybody got up at 1 o'clock for lunch, and he'd wake up and go to lunch. I never once spoke to him. He was always asleep, right? So that was, like, so actually, like, it's a real big claim. You never slept in the Bet Midrash. Like, I can't say that. Can anyone hear?
Yeah.
Huh? Have you ever slept in the Bet Midrash?
Obviously.
Exactly, right?
No.
You never slept in a Bet Midrash?
Not even a short sleep.
Okay. So it's a big deal. V'lohi nachti adam bebet midrash v'yatzati. I never left a person. I never left. That was last Shabbat. I never left a person in the Bet Midrash. I was always the first one in and the last one out. V'loh sachti sichat cholim. Never battled, never spoke about non-Torah topics in the Bet Midrash. Velo amalti davar shelo shamati mipi Rebbe me'olam. And I never said anything, he concludes with where he started, I never said anything that I didn't hear from my teacher. And so, in answer to your question of, can you work out the other 18 answers from the 12 that you have answered? The answer is, no, I cannot, because it is a hard principle for me. I will never say anything I haven't heard it from my teachers. If I heard it from my teachers, I will remember it, and I will remember it forever. I'm a cemented cistern that doesn't lose a drop. But if I haven't heard it, I am not going to say it. I am about, you pick one word to describe all this. Hebrew or English? Nope. Fiddler on the roof.
Tradition.
There you go. Exactly. Mesorah. Tradition. That's who I am. If it's tradition, if I've heard it, Great. If I haven't, then I will not say it. People see how this connects up to the previous source? Right? People see what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was talking about? Why won't he say something new? Why won't he say something he hasn't heard? What's wrong with that?
Do you want an answer, delving into the metaphors again, or like?
No, not necessarily. What do you think is motivating him?
A lot of Judaism is built on precedent and tradition and honoring previous people. This is just that extended to a.
To an extreme.
Arguably, yeah, ineffective extreme.
So the simple answer is, well, it might be wrong. If he's heard it from his teachers,
right.
He knows it's right. But I think I'm with Sarah that it goes beyond that. It's not only simply it might be wrong, but it needs to have the stamp of tradition in order for it to be Torah that he will say.
I feel like I was about to say something that I'm assuming you're getting to.
Okay.
So
Unnecessary.
I don't normally like sharing these sorts of readings because I think they're normally sort of shallow and anachronistic.
Yeah.
But I did once see a very interesting online discussion as to whether or not, and I say this very respectfully and sensitively, whether you see in Rabbi Eliezer certain sort of characteristics which today we'd identify with autism. And the people having the discussion were people who either they're autistic or their kids are, and I was sort of watching it very interestedly. I can't remember exactly what they pointed out as being those elements of it, but it was a very interesting discussion. I don't know. I can try and dig it up if people are interested. But yeah, there's clearly a lot in this response, right? Like it's a boom response that he gives, and we're going to see he's a giant character. But
well,
let's...
No, I'm going to be looking for that. So that's...
He's a character.
No, I like it when they're characters. Nobody's going to beat Rabbi Yirmiyah, though. Nobody's ever going to beat Rabbi Yirmiyah who asked a dumb question and got kicked out of class. That's about
pigeon.
That's
about pigeon. Okay, let's move to Rabbi Akiva. And we're gonna okay, good. Let's move to Rabbi Akiva. I can show you some other fun stories as well. Rabbi Yochanan had 10 children die, and he would carry around the bones of his youngest child with him.
That's not funny.
Story for you, Sarah. Okay. Yeah, see.
I just wasn't expecting that to...
Well, you set me up for it. Okay. Let's move to Rabbi Akiva, and we'll come back to Rabbi Eliezer. Now, if you know one thing about Rabbi Akiva, what do you know? Biographical.
Started learning Torah at 40.
Exactly right. He comes to this game late, right? He doesn't grow up with this. Even just knowing that, you can tell he's not going to be the same kind of person as Rabbi Eliezer, right? Let's look at one of the versions of Rabbi Akiva's sort of origin story. Mahe atchilato shel Rabbi Akiva. What was his beginning? Amru, it said, ben 40 shana haya v'lo shena klum. He was 40 years old and he knew nothing. Pam achat, once happened, haya omed al pi haba'er, was standing by a stream, seemingly a fast flowing stream. And he sees a rock and he sees an indent in the rock. And he says, Michikek evenzu. Who made this dent in the rock? Amru lo, the people there, said to him, Hamayim, it was the water. Shetadir noflim aleha b'chol yom, which is always falling on the rock. Miyad haya Rabbi Akiva damkal v'chomil ma'atzim. Rabbi Akiva, who didn't know Aleph Bet, who'd certainly never learned anything at all, made a kal v'chomil. What was his kal v'chomil? Ma rach pasal etakasheh. Just as the soft breaks or makes an impression on the hard, in other words, soft water is making an impression on the hard rock. Divrei Torah shekashin kabarzel, words of Torah which are as hard as iron. There's a lot in that that he thinks that's the case, but let's accept that for now. Al achat kama v'kama, how much more so shechakaku et libi, that they should make an impression on my heart. Shehu basar v'dam, which is just soft flesh and blood. Miyad chazar l'ilmod Torah. From here he goes to study. Halachu benovi yeshu etzel melamdei tinokot. He and his son go to kindergarten. They go to the teacher of children to learn Aleph Bet. This is the classic story, right? He doesn't know anything. And at age 40, he decides that he's going to begin on this incredible journey.
A school play about this, and my job was I played air guitar.
Cool. I didn't see that in the Midrash, but...
No,
good to...
it was an expanded edition.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. A Midrash.
The cast, Rabbi Akiva, his wife, and they were actor characters.
And the air guitar. It's a lovely, simple story. I just want to focus on one detail. Anyone guess what that detail is?
Erosion.
Not erosion?
The analogy being imperfect.
The analogy's a really interesting one. That's worthy of discussion, but that's not my thought for now. He makes a Kal v'chomer. Here's someone who doesn't know anything. He hasn't spent any time in a Bet Midrash. He's never learned anything. But already, like in his like DNA sort of thing, as he like encounters the world, he's got that creativity. A Kal v'chomer, just in case anyone's not clear, is when you look at one case.
An
a fortiori argument, that's right.
Seen before.
That's the English Latin for it, an a fortiori argument, where you make an analogy from one case to another. If a certain thing applies in one case, all the more so it will apply in another case. It's at the very, very heart of like how Jewish Talmudic thinking works. And even before Rabbi Akiva has learned anything, he already knows that. What's a Kal v'chomer the opposite of? Think creatively here. What's the opposite of a Kal v'chomer?
Even less so.
Taking something out on its surface.
The opposite of a Kal v'chomer is source number 3. People get that? The opposite of a Kal v'chomer is when somebody says to you, do you know the answer to this? And I say, well, I know the answer to other things, but I'm not going to try and extrapolate from them the answers to other things, right? When Rabbi Eliezer says, I've never said anything that my teachers didn't tell me, that is the opposite of a Kal v'chomer. A Kal v'chomer means I'm going to take one case and I'm going to try and work out principles from it that I can apply to another case. Rabbi Eliezer says, I'm not going to ever apply anything to any other case because I'm only going to say things I've heard from my teachers. So already right there, you can see there's going to be some tension between these two approaches. Here is a lovely Gemara, which is going to be very, very indicative of Rabbi Akiva's approach, but it's also a beautiful Gemara, which is worth knowing by itself. You can cut it out and put it up on your wall as top five Talmudic insights into what learning is. It's a story about a man called Nehemiah Ha'amsoni. Now, Nehemiah Ha'amsoni had a theory. He was had a very interesting theory. Hayad Doresh Kol Etin Shebatorah. He would expound every single time the word et appeared in the Torah. What does the word et mean?
It's like a connecting word.
It doesn't mean anything, exactly. Right? It's a grammatical invention which there is no translation for if you ever look at a verse which has the word et.
Particles.
I think it's called an auxiliary word in English. In any case, Rabbi Nehemiah Ha'amsoni had a theory that actually every time the word et appeared, it concealed some meaning. Right? If I have a pasuk, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim, ve'et ha'aretz, in the beginning God created et the heavens and et the earth, there's some teaching lurking in there. Rabbi Nehemiah would expound all of those. If we're in Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzmaut territory, then let's at least tell some great Zionist legends. This was a very important machloket between David Ben-Gurion and the poet Chaim Nachman Bialik as to whether or not modern Hebrew should include the word et. Okay, right, we're coming back to the land of Israel in the 20th century. We're going to remake the Hebrew language. We've got this ancient biblical language from thousands of years ago. Something is going to say the same, something is going to be different. Do we include the word et? Anyone guess who said what? Said yes to... Correct. Exactly. Bialik, who's got the poet's ear, says obviously we have to keep this great classic word. Ben-Gurion, who's this sort of secular, socialist, scientific type, planned economy type, you know, if it's not serving a purpose, then... Exactly, then it's not useful. So Nehemiah Ha'amsoni is somewhere between the two,
right? He thinks that every etch is very important, but because it serves a purpose. One day, though, he found a pasuk which he didn't like, when everything went very bad. Kevan Shehigia, one day he got to Devarim chapter 6, and he found the verse, Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, Et the Lord your God you shall fear. Piresh. He gave it all up. People see the problem with that pasuk? Exactly. You should fear Hashem, right? That means you shouldn't fear other things. If you fear other things, you're not fearing Hashem. You're fearing those other things. So the word et there can't include anything else. And if the word et there doesn't include anything else, then who's to say that any other time it appears, it includes anything else?
Oh, no.
Amru lo talmidav.
His big project.
Well, just wait, I've got a gem to share with you. His students say to him, Rebbe, kol etin shadarashta matahei alehem. All of the ets that you expounded, what's going to happen to them? Right? I'm looking at the Bet Midrash, like you've got reams of works on et. Now, I'm a geek, and I once decided to look up how many times the word et appears from Bereshit Bara Elokim et Hashemayim ve'et Haaretz in Bereshit chapter 1 until Devarim chapter 6. No, I didn't look in Concordancia. I used Bar Ilan and got the answer in about 5 seconds.
Then aren't you really a geek?
I guess not. Anyone want to give a bull mark? Guess?
4,000.
4,000? Sorry? 2,000.
No. It's got to be
higher. It's a long time ago I looked at it. I think it's in the 6,000s. It appears a lot. it can be said.
Does
and he gives it all up.
That include every like type of bet?
I think. Oh, maybe.
I think I might have
isolated it. I'm not sure. Should look it up. But, you know, you can just say the first pasuk of the Torah and you see that the word appears a lot.
Yeah.
And he gives the most beautiful answer. This is really something to remember. This is something to, like, really take with you as you carry on in Jewish learning. Kashem shekibalti schar al hadrisha, kach kibalti schar al haprisha. Just as I received reward for expounding, for saying this is what I think the word et means in every case, so too I'm going to get reward for taking it back, for recanting, for saying I was wrong. See how beautiful that is?
That is really, I like that a lot.
We normally think, and I think we're encouraged to think in sort of the way in which a lot of modern learning and thinking goes, if you're right, you're right. If you're wrong, you're wrong. If you spent time being wrong, then that's a waste of time. He's saying exactly the opposite. There is reward for saying it, and then there's also a great level to being taken for taking it back. It's even more than that, though, isn't
it?
Yeah. Eilu Veilu says they're both right. This is saying, I spent, presumably it took him quite a while to work out 6,000, you know, interpretations of what the word et means. And he doesn't feel I'm back to zero. He doesn't feel I've wasted time. No, he's back where he was, but he's much richer for it. The Gemara doesn't end here. I think Rabbi Sachs would describe this Gemara as being like a great black humour. Here comes Rabbi Akiva.
Black humour? Like
black humour, dark humour. Ad Shabbat Rabbi Akiva. Until Rabbi Akiva came, velimed, and taught, et Hashem Elokecha Tira, et the Lord your God you shall fear, l'rabot talmidei chachamim. I can find something else to include in it. It is Talmidei Chachamim. There is a way of including in that pasuk the word et, an additional teaching which doesn't detract from it, but which actually does. So what Rabbi Akiva does is he props the theory back up.
Does not so much to do with the points of this midrash, but does that mean Rabbi Akiva believed that like the Chachamim should be feared the same way that you fear God?
Great question. I don't quite think so. I have sometimes had people think like, oh, that's a strange reading. And did I write fear here? I think fear is not a precise translation. I think reverence is a better one. But let's take your point. Let's think about it a little bit. Firstly, yes, Sam.
I just respond. I think it's more of to include Talmidei Chachamim in that because of their relationship or because of the connection they have to God through Torah, and I guess respect for that element of
If you learn, if you can access God through learning God's Torah, and if you can learn Torah through... Right, or it's contained within it. Yeah, fair. On the most basic level, I just want to point out, who is Rabbi Akiva? He is the person who, once everybody has given up on a text, they think everything that can be said has been said, he's able to squeeze more meaning out of it. He's able to say, when everyone's given up, he says, no, I'm going to find something else in it. That's the first level here. That's the most basic level. I once learned this Gemara with a woman who had never done any Jewish learning before. She was Rabbi Akiva of source number 4. She had never learned any Jewish texts before. It was her first time learning. She asked me to learn some stuff with her, so I thought I'd teach her this source. She had the most beautiful interpretation of it. It was the most amazing thing to see someone who'd never done any learning before come up with something that's beautiful. She said, you see what Rabbi Akiva's doing? He's making Nechemiah Ha'am Soni feel better. He's doing it, he's restoring his kavod. How is he doing that? Not only is he saying, no, your theory does work, and not only can I make a reading here, but all of your other thousands of readings work. But what's the specific reading he's doing? He's saying, I have reverence for you, and we should have reverence for you. When Nechemiah Ha'amasoni's student said to him, Kol etin shadarashta matahei alehen, what's going to happen to all the ets you expounded? And he gave a beautiful answer. But maybe his students thought, yeah, but tachlis, you're wrong, right? And what does Rabbi Akiva do? He props it back up. He says, no. He says, it works, and I've got great reverence for you. That's isn't it amazing? Someone who literally, she'd never seen any Gemara ever, and she had that beautiful read. There's something very, very inspiring in that. Third thing to say on it is, again, Rabbi Eliezer would never say that. Right? This is something that no one has ever said before. He is not scared at all of Chiddush, Rabbi Akiva. Right? Rabbi Akiva is happy to say new things that no one else has ever thought of. And just in case you think I'm making all of this up, we've got multiple examples of where Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, they sort of like clash with one another in how they like read verses. Once again, Sukkot. Laman yedu dorateichem ki b'sukkot hashavti et b'nei Yisrael b'otziyotam me'eretz Mitzrayim. In order that your generation should know, this is why we are in Sukkot, on the festival of Sukkot, because Hashem caused us to dwell in Sukkot. We left Egypt. What does that mean? What are the Sukkot? Rabbi Eliezer omer Sukkot mamash hayu. They were actual Sukkot. Rabbi Akiva omer b'sukkot anenei hakavod hayu. No, they were the clouds of glory. One is simple, straightforward. One is creative, interpretive. We've got, there are many other examples of it as well. This source we can't not do just because it's such a wacky source. This source, like, forgive me, it's like a rap battle. These Talmidei Chachamim, they're like talking about how good their Torah is. Each one's giving like metaphors to talk about how great their stuff is. You can really like, you know, this is awesome. So here's Rabbi Eliezer. Here's how Rabbi Eliezer describes how brilliant my Torah is. Im hu kol hayamim dayo. If all of the seas were ink. Va'agamim kol mosim v'shamayim v'aretz megilot. The heavens and the earth were scrolls, parchment. V'kol b'nei adam l'baolim. And all of the people on earth were scribes. Imagine that. Right, that storage capacity. Ein maspikin lichtov Torah shelamadati. It would not be enough to write all of the Torah that I know.
That doesn't make any sense, because he had to read it.
Yeah, I was thinking that, and then I was like, but what if he had chidush? And I was like, wait, he doesn't.
Yeah,
exactly. Oh, but I guess it was.
This is the original cloud.
It's just a metaphor, guys.
Yeah. But it's a bad metaphor.
It's an awesome metaphor.
Honestly,
a metaphor doesn't need to be precise in all of its ways in order to capture something. As in, if you could imagine the most enormous potential... And by the way, again, these are people who obviously never knew digital storage, right? So imagine the most enormous potential, like, space of writing.
Was he living when it was still, like, just oral Torah? Cause
yes.
Okay, so that makes more sense, because then maybe you can imagine all of the Mishnah being...
It wouldn't hold everything that I say. And there are a few more of these ones. Contrast this with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Ein bi koach lomar kamo sha'amru rabotai. I haven't got the strength, the power to like be like my teachers. You know, like, look, I only started learning when I was 40. I definitely don't know as much as Rabbi Eliezer. And now here's the most confusing line of the whole piece, which I've taught it hundreds of times. I still don't know what these few words mean. Ela rabotai chisrua v'ani lo chasarte. I'm translating this very carefully because, again, I'm still not exactly sure what it means. When my teachers teach, they are lessened. When I teach, I am not lessened. And that is brought out a little bit by his next metaphor, which is, again, beautiful. This is a real shiur on metaphors. What am I like? What's my style of teaching like? Kamareach be'etrog. Like someone who smells an etrog. Hamareach nehene, the person who smells it benefits, they enjoy it. V'ha'etrog lo chaser. But the etrog's not lacking afterwards. It's not as if like you've by smelling an etrog, you haven't like taken away from the etrog. It's still the same.
Not how we understood.
I'm like someone who fills up a bucket from a fast-flowing stream. The bucket is full, but the stream's not empty. Kamadlik miner lener, like a candle which lights another candle. It's created a second light, but it hasn't taken away from its first light. That's what my teaching is like. There's a lot packed into these 2.5 lines, right?
Say when you do smell things, and this is no discredit to what this is genuinely poetic writing, but just so everyone knows, when you smell things, like you are absorbing particles of that thing.
Like Michael said. What Michael said before?
This time it isn't a criticism. Before it was a genuine criticism. Before it was like, you couldn't have read more, with infinite space, you couldn't have read the finite books I've read. This is like just a comment on science. Like, this is beautiful poetry.
So what does it mean? What's Rabbi Akiva saying? It's really like, you need to think about this. It's not a simple source.
I'm not sure what it means, like why he thinks it would be different for his teachers.
Right, that's the complex part. Gabriella?
I think that there's an emphasis on Rabbi Akiva's Torah being expansive and that he's not afraid of fidushim. And it's if you teach a bunch of people who aren't afraid of fidushim, then they're going to come up with their own ideas and their own fidushim. So in that way, his Torah is expansive. It's like the more he teaches his students, the more the students know, A, what he taught them, and B, in an expansive manner, they can come up with their own fidushim. And then just to compare it to what Rabbi Eliezer says, is like, you can write every single thing that I know, and it's infinite, and you'll never be able to finish it. But, like, it's kind of that illustration of, like, you're trying to write down every single thing versus Rabbi Akiva's, like, I'm a light that keeps lighting, like, it's not going to diminish the flame. And, like, my ideas are going to, like, continue to create versus, I don't know, actually Rabbi Akiva says this is infinite, too. They're both commenting on, like, infiniteness.
Okay, it's a good start, Raquel.
Sort of going off of that, like, my interpretation of, like, the whole, like, lesson situation of, like, his teachers, I think what he's trying to say, almost, like, as a rebuke of Rabbi Eliezer, and also, like, relating back to the earlier Gemara, where Rabbi Eliezer says that he only, like, says what his teachers say, is that I think Rabbi Akiva is commenting on how when his teachers teach something, if you're somebody like Rabbi Eliezer, then there's nothing else more that you can get from that. So there's actually less for them to teach you once they've taught you something else, once they've taught you something, because you can't get anything more out of it. So, like, you follow what I'm saying? Like, once they teach you something, there's less for them to actually teach you of what they know.
Right.
Does that make sense?
That's excellent. That's what I've always thought of as the interpretation. Here's the way in which I think about it. Rabbi Eliezer knows an enormous amount, but it's data. It's quantitative.
Right?
Right,
so he's like the
Remember the first Gemara? They asked him 30 questions, and he said, 12 I've heard, 18 I haven't. He has 12, right? He's got 12 things to give. He's got 12 things that he can give to someone else. Rabbi Akiva, it's not about the data itself. He doesn't know as much as Rabbi Eliezer. He hasn't heard as much. He's not this huge receptacle, this cistern, which doesn't lose anything.
He was 40 when he started.
Great. But what has he got? He's got a creativity. I think Gabrielle, I think this is what you were coming close to saying. He's teaching a style as much as he's teaching any individual approaches. And I think that's what it means, the lessened versus not lessened. I think there's still more there, but I think that's what it means. Sam?
It's kind of like the paradigmatic example of I learned a lot from my teachers, I learned most of my students. It's, I think he was saying that when you learn with new people, when you share something with someone new, they'll often bring a new perspective and make you think of something in a different way. Even just from the sheet, for example, you mentioned that Gabrielle said in the growing that no one had ever said it on the teaching yet. Or if you sit in a lecture for college, in our classes, whenever the professor's done, it's not that they're like, okay, now but what do you think? What's your take on this?
Right.
Right? It's like they say it and then they share it, but they're not gaining anything. And not even gaining, they're not thinking about things in a different way.
Right. Right.
Fair.
Eitan?
It kind of feels like a distinction between Das and Bina, or maybe Chachma and Bina.
Explain.
I think of...
One is knowledge per se, the other is more intuition?
Maybe intuition or something from experience, something from relationships between people. I think I often get tired and angry at academia because it's such an annoying system of learning things, but it is also helpful. You gain so much out of it. That at the end of the day, it doesn't do anything,
right?
If you're just always in academia and you don't leave that space for
apply it somewhere,
and maybe his students were able to do that.
I've taught this many times, and someone pointed this out the last time. I never quite thought of it. They're not exactly talking about the same thing. Rabbi Eliezer is talking about the Torah that he knows. If you had this huge amount of space, it wouldn't be enough to write all the Torah that I know. Rabbi Akiva is not actually talking about the Torah he knows. Rabbi Akiva is talking about his approach to teaching. And so I think coming to your point, it's relational.
Yeah.
Right? Rabbi Eliezer doesn't actually involve anyone else.
Yeah.
The only other people are potentially scribes. Right? But for Rabbi Akiva, it's all about his student who's learning from him. Here's a source I didn't put on the...
But I'm confused why...
Why they're lessened?
Yeah.
Well, I'm open to other readings, definitely. I'm not sure it's perfect, but what I've always thought is what Raquel said, that the other ones, they're like data. That's like, how much do they know? They know 12 things in Hilchot Sukkah. They know an enormous amount, but it's an amount. It's a data amount.
It ends. It starts and ends.
Right, and when they've taught it, then they haven't got more to teach. They are lessened because they've now got less to teach you.
Versus an eternal wisdom, which is different.
Yeah,
I'm open to other readings, but that's the simplest one.
But he's saying it with the implication of all other teachers are like that, not just...
The ones who've spoken prior to him who have sort of talked about amounts. I think it's a...
Okay.
I think it's a...
It's a type of teacher.
I think it's a contrast in qualitative and quantitative, I think. I'm open to other ones. Right. Right. Here's a source I didn't put on this sheet, but it's a well-known source. It's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Mesora Sayag LeTorah. Says Rabbi Akiva, tradition is the fence of Torah. That kind of sounds a bit strange, right? That sounds a bit like a Rabbi Eliezer statement. Yeah?
I've heard this one before, and this particularly is one thing that I appreciate about tradition, and also really don't like it, because the fence is something that safeguards. So it safeguards the Torah, especially in times like these where you don't have Binyan Gosh anymore. So you really need to safeguard what you have in tradition, and that's the whole point behind it. Because the farther you deviate,
mm-hmm.
Then the farther away you get, and you could lose everything. But at the same time, a fence is also what traps something in,
okay.
And also what makes halacha... I mean, everybody says, halacha is supposed to change, but I always
right.
like to think that the world is changing faster than halacha does.
Right.
And so I think that's also very much
okay.
halacha and
Michael, you said it doesn't...
I don't know the full mission of it. That's a very radical statement. He's just saying that the tradition is offensive to Torah. He's not saying tradition is Torah.
Yeah, fair. Very, very good. Exactly. Tradition just marks the outer boundaries. It's what you can't go beyond. Or if you're sure you can go beyond it, but then you're not talking Torah anymore. There was a great Jewish philosopher, a man who passed away a number of years ago. I went to his funeral, a man called Michael Wishegrod. His father had been a chess grandmaster in Europe. And in one of his philosophy books, Michael Wishegrod compares Judaism to a game of chess. He says, think about chess. Chess, more than any other game, has got stricter rules. Okay? Like, you can't move a rook, a castle, in a diagonal direction. If you do that, well, you can, but like you're not playing chess then. You can't move a bishop straight. You can't move a king more than one space at a time. It's very tightly regulated. But, as I'm told, chess has also got by far the most greatest potential for creativity, for combinations, for strategy, than any other game. In other words, the tradition sort of like...
More than shogi?
I wouldn't go to war on this point. But the point is that there's actually, and this can seem a bit counterintuitive, but there's actually a connection between a strong sort of traditional sort of casing and then allowing for huge creativity. That's what Rabbi Akiva was saying. That's what I understood you to be saying, Michael. What would Rabbi Eliezer say? Rabbi Eliezer would say,
tradition is
exactly. Masorah is not a fence for the Torah, like delineating an area within which you can be creative. Masorah is the Torah. There is nothing that is Torah which is not Masorah. If you haven't heard it, if it hasn't come down in the chain of tradition, then it's not Torah. For Rabbi Akiva, it's just the boundary marker. We can finish here. It's late. This is setting us up for like really where to run from here, because once we've set this up, a lot is going to flow from it. I do realise it's late, we've got finals, so happy to make this part one. Unless
who said that thing about chess?
Michael Wishegrod, Wyschogrod. Great book. His main book is called Body of Faith.
Why did you go to his funeral?
I went to his funeral. Well, his daughter asked me that, actually, at his funeral.
Why are you here?
She said, who are you? There were Michael Wishegrod. He had a big impact on me and my friends over the years. We read his stuff, and I thought he said things which I hadn't seen anywhere else and which were very powerful and strong. And he had a big impact on me. And then I came to America in summer 2015, and I think he passed away in 2017. And I just got like saw online he passed away, and his funeral was going to be such and such a day. And I got there, went to his funeral, Jersey, on a Friday morning, and there were 25 people there.
What?
Yeah. And like this was like he was an early student of Rav Soloveitchik. I don't think there's an orthodox like theologian on a par with him really in the English speaking world, second half of the 20th century. And
Rabbi Sacks wasn't a theologian, in your opinion?
He definitely was, but I think Rabbi Sacks was a rabbi, and was a darshan, and with that he definitely did theology. But Michael Wishegrod was a pure theologian, and I was very like impacted that like there were so few people there. So his daughter came up to, I think she knew everyone there apart from me, and she said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm just a Joe, and I liked your dad's, I appreciate your dad's writing." She was very appreciative. And then I came back, and it was gave a Friday night drasha here, and I said, "The Gemara in Ketubot says." Slikta kunatinta, that the Torah is removed just as it's given, that there should always be people at any funeral, but for one who's taught great Torah, just as the Torah was given with 600,000 people present, so too the Torah, there should be 600,000 people when Torah is removed. And I said there were 25 people, but it's wanted to go there. I always go to funerals, by the way. And it's a serious point. Tov lalechet lebet avel milalechet lebet mishteh, as Pasuk in Kohelet. Better to go to a funeral than to a feast. Like you learn a lot about people at funerals, and you get a lot. So that's why I went, and very very glad that I did. He was a great man. Plenty more of his Torah to teach. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Eliezer, two completely different ways of looking at what Torah should be. One is about tradition and remembering everything and making sure nothing is broken. The other is so much more about creativity and about chidush. This is going to set up one of the ultimate, like, showdowns, really, that has been within our tradition, and we'll find another time to do it. Think next week. All right, good. Tuesday night next week. It's important stuff. Shkoyach.
It's just interesting that the praise that Rabbi Ezra gets is significant.